So tonight I want to talk about digital contracts, and I'm posing the question, is this another disruptor to the industry? And when we look through it, I'll give some examples and some predictions where people have made that prediction, but I'll sort of hopefully touch on some of the capabilities of digital contracts and what areas in particular they could disrupt. I'll give some examples from my experiences as well in this space. But to begin with, I want to go back, as we just saw, back in time. So back in 2001, I worked for a startup company, and we were building digital rights management systems, CRM. And one of the things we thought about in those days was this tension between business, technical, legal, and the social world. When you're building a new system like a digital rights management system, you have to sort of look at those characteristics and see, well, where do we solve the problems and where are we laying the foundations? So back in 2001, the most of the solutions were technically based, because you could do it. Technology says we can do something, so we're going to just do it, which is, you know, has some drawbacks to it. So DRM, or rights management, and in particular for things like, this is the early days of e-books, we're talking about e-books online and managing their rights, etc. The direction was, we have a technology, let's go with it. Don't worry about the social side or the people side. The legal side, well, we'll worry about that when we ever have to worry about it. And the business cases were sort of involved. But so we had things like this back in 2001. So this was Adobe's version of their rights management settings. And you can do interesting things, like you could either be permitted to copy 10 bits of text every 5 days. You could do things like you can print X pages every X days. But the real funny one was the bottom one, which was the one that got them in trouble, was this read aloud, where they actually said you couldn't allow the text of the audio of the book, for example, to be read out aloud. So those with disabilities could not actually hear the book. So even though technically they could do it, it was something that they thought this would be a great option in a rights management system. So that became a bit of fodder for us back in 2001. And you think, great, you know, what year is it now? 2017. But Adobe still has the very same setting in their PDF security settings as well, to be able to turn off screen readers, for example. So we haven't really moved forward in many ways in terms of the social side of things. But rights management is something that's been around from a machine readable rights management, I'm talking about here, since about 2000. And there are a lot of languages available at the time from different companies. XRML was one, ODRL was the other one, which is the one I've been promoting. And there was a lot of standardization, in particularly the MPEG, the video audio standardization group. They were looking at how to standardize machine readable rights. And when you got your video file downloaded it today, you'll be able to manage your rights or pay royalties or express the way that it can be constrained. So you're going to play it on certain devices or for certain time periods. And there were lots of different standards bodies looking at it. IEEE were looking at it. OMA, which was the Mobile Alliance, were looking at it. So mobile content was another big area where rights management was going to be a major player. Photographs. And then we're all familiar with Creative Commons is another way of doing rights management. It's very much a simplified instant license scenario where you can simply just search saying, here's some content and here's a license. It's just a URL that says what you can and cannot do with it. But the very fixed sort of term is not flexible in terms of what you can state in terms of the permissions and obligations. And just for fun, in those days, there was a lot of patents as well. So there's a big patent fight over who owns the rights to managing rights. And so it really got into a really hairy, scary time. But that, of course, is never-ending part of the landscape. So what we what's sort of more recently is the one language, the Open Digital Rights language, has now become an official language, a part of the World Wide Web Consortium standardization. So W3C is the group that the web founder Tim Berners-Lee runs, and they set all the standards for the web, HTML5 and all those, etc., are all part of W3C. So now we have a way, in a machine-readable way, that we can now express rights, and particularly not so much rights, but you can also generalize that as a policy. So if there's some sort of rules that you want to express and you want to attach that to a piece of content and to enable people to see what they allow or can't do, then this is the type of language we're doing now. So there's, I won't go into details there because it gets a bit hairy. I'll give you a couple of screens in a moment, but there's some documents there which talk about the information model and the vocabulary. So it's also very based recently on some semantic web ontology, so we have reasoning and all that sort of stuff available in the rights language. But the current process is to use some new use cases to help us build some advances to the language to help IDRL hopefully become a standard contract language. Contract language being a way that you can express terms and conditions over a particular item. And a note there that at the bottom there, it's not about enforcement, it's a language, so we express things, we can't actually enforce anything, because it's like any language, we're just sort of expressing statements, it's not a system where we can enforce things. So for example there, those who are interested, that's the model behind the language. You can, the bottom there, the permission, duty and prohibition allows you to state what you can do, what you must do, and what you may not do. So that's the model we use. And they can be applied to any asset, and any party can play a role in that. And of course there are constraints, so you can constrain things such as time periods, etc. But that model, that's another version of it. But just want to show you that's the model, but the vocabulary is where the power comes in. So the vocabulary tells you in particular domains what you can and cannot do. So there could be a whole heap of different actions there, such as things like to give away content, to modify content, to annotate content, to aggregate it, play it, print it, read it, reproduce. And there could be a different set of constraints as well. So depending on your domain, the vocabulary will be specific. But the overall model is one that can encapsulate those rules. So that's what a rights language or a policy language tries to do. So it just tries to express things. But in the current market, the rights management market, particularly the DRM market, there's a lot of proprietary solutions. You can go out and buy them today from the big players. Google has one, Microsoft, and of course we saw Adobe has one. Apple has their own called Fairplay, which they use quite a lot on the iPhone. And the interesting thing about that sort of scenario is that Apple did what was opposite to what people were thinking about. They went out and did big music deals or rights deals with music companies. So instead of having sort of like each individual music artist participate in the value chain, which is what we originally thought was going to happen, that is the creator was going to be the one who's going to express the rights over their content. What Apple did was just went to Sony Music and said, I'm going to buy all your content. Here's a squillion dollars. And then they sell it on the on their platform. But they own that whole ecosystem, so they can do that. So that's one of the reasons why the Apple Music sort of scenario worked quite well. Yeah. But they're all proprietary. And that's one of the issues for them as a consumer from the social point of view. I'm locked into those ecosystems if I participate in it. And to make it even worse, this is just a table there. Across the top there is all the different DRM systems, and down the side is all different devices, hardware devices, software devices. And you can sort of see, to support every DRM system across all devices, all different web browsers, all different platforms, it's a nightmare. So it's something that doesn't help the consumer in any way. So what W3C did in part of their HTML new spec is they developed a extension called EME, or Encrypted Media Extensions. Again, it's another W3C standard. The idea behind EME is that we can now, through a common web browser, we can actually access proprietary content that's been encrypted. So he manages how to unencrypt it as part of the AME standard itself. But the good thing here is that from a standard web browser now, I can access encrypted content in an interoperable way. So I don't need to worry, is this Microsoft, is this Adobe, is this OMA, is this Apple, etc., etc. So we have now an interoperable way now to actually make the content available to the end user. So that's just making the content, the media, available. We're still not talking about rights just at this point, but at least there's now a way that we can break down some of the interoperability when we have a contract over usage of content. And just not to be outdone, there's a lot of this is the one controversial spec that W3C has produced in its 20 odd years of existence. So the Electronic Frontier Foundation was against this because it was DRM, and DRM is a bad word in many circles because it's about restricting my access to my content. So there's been a lot of protests and articles and unseen sort of media attention about this one spec that W3C has dealt with. But it is not standardizing DRM, it's just standardizing how that you access to a DRM system. So there's no actual enforcement in there, it's just accessing the content. So there's a bit more controversy about all that. So this then says, well, part of the controversy is that, well, not the controversy, is that the transparency, if you like, of the actual rights information, like, is still hidden across all of these. So that was another sort of area that would need to be solved in terms of the whole ecosystem. So that then brings me to this thing called the blockchain, which most people might have heard of, or you probably heard of Bitcoins, more likely. So the blockchain is part of that infrastructure. It's commonly described as a distributed ledger. So it's an open distributed ledger. So it basically records publicly transactions. So there's a lot of crypto that goes on to make sure it's all secure. I won't go into details, but in essence, you basically have a lot of transactions that are linked to each other, and you can go through the ledger, you can see. And once, if there's some sort of tampering that goes on with the ledger, then that can be obviously found out, and therefore you can then work out whether the ledger has been changed, because then there will be some sort of system sort of response to that. But the whole idea behind the blockchain is that it's immutable, so it can't be changed. Because these transactions are encrypted with the cryptography, you can't actually change them. You can only add stuff to it. So that's part of the beauty of the blockchain. This is public ledger. You know it can't be changed. It's been created by a group of 6,000 or so different stakeholders who have got the mechanism to create the transactions and verify the transactions to put them on the blockchain. So just an example from the Bitcoin has its blockchain. You can actually watch this live. If you go to blockchain.info, you can sort of see all the transactions flowing through. Down the bottom where those green buttons are, that's all the current transactions that are currently flowing through. It tells you, gives you the value of each one that are occurring for the Bitcoins. And then at the top there, it shows you every 10 minutes or so, there's a group of transactions that get verified. The system or the participants in that will verify, yep, that's a correct encoding of the transactions, and they go into the blockchain ledger as verified transactions. And as an incentive, of course, whoever does that gets paid. So that's the incentive behind it. So there's independent systems out there, people running these systems that are doing all the cryptography to make sure that the transactions are verified. And then every 10 minutes that block is then voted on. So yeah, that's correct, into the blockchain. So there's a lot of information about how the blockchain transactions are authenticated. But in essence, you have this transparent way of having a public ledger out there for recording transactions. So there's lots of uses of the blockchain. Verification is one, which is what I talk about today, particularly about licenses, proof of records, transactions, any process, did that event occur? Because it's just all public, so you can always verify, go and have a look, did that occur, was that license created, who asserted transactions about particular content, who was paid what. Movement of assets, moving money, of course, so is one of the common ones with bitcoins. Ownership, land titles, so governments are looking at it to see whether they can use that instead of having their own internal repository of land ownership. You can just put it onto the blockchain. It's all made public now. So it's a much more transparent ways of governments recording information. And identities as well, issuing identifiers via the blockchain as well. So the main sort of use really is supply chain transparency. So particularly if you've got a lot of different players involved, different stakeholders, and there's a need for transparency, then the blockchain is actually a very useful technology to help in that particular use case. So not so much if you just wanted a database, you know, if you're just a single organization which wanted a single database, then you probably could just use a database and get away with it. But if you have a lot of supply chains, different stakeholders, and there's a need for transparency, then the blockchain would be a useful platform to use. So as an example, the area that we're doing some work in is with music. And that the whole music industry. So the whole music industry has been around obviously for a long time, and it's a very antiquated and complex world in the music industry. It's not as simple as we think as a consumer. We think we go into a record store, just bought a record, and then the artist will get paid and that's all over and done with. But that's not how it all works out. There's lots of different complex rights holders in there. There's different types of performance rights. There's a lot of intermediaries in there. There's a lot of distributors. There's a lot of collection organisations and societies that act on your behalf as a creator and an author. And there's different types of licensing that goes on around the world. There's also different statutory licensing that happens in different jurisdictions. So it's a very complex back-of-house operation in the music industry. And really that the system itself delivers values really to the owners of those processes. So if you're a player in there, you want to keep being a player because you get benefit from being in that process. So that diagram up there is very complex, there's different stakeholders. That's really what's happening in the process there. A lot of transactions and a lot of people make money. Not necessarily the artists, unfortunately. The artist always is the one that ends up losing in terms of the royalties. So the blockchain here is a really good mechanism that could provide transparency and also immediacy as well. Because within 10 minutes, these transactions can become public, whereas a lot of transactions in the music world take months and months to actually occur. So there's a lot of new music companies now actually being formed that purely around the blockchain. There's a few listed there, you know, and they're getting venture capital to manage music rights using the blockchain. So there's a lot of options out there, a lot of movement in this space. So this is probably one area that could potentially be disrupted hopefully the near future. So music. Just as an example there, some of you might remember the Backstreet Boys or NSYNC, those boy bands. So they sued their manager back in 2005 and around that period because, you know, the music industry is one where people say, yep, I'll give you those royalties, I'll pay you that amount of money and that, but none of that actually occurs because there's no legal contract, it's usually just word of mouth. So, you know, this is what happened back in the 2000s, mid-2000s, a lot of bands were suing record companies, managers. So there's really the opportunity now is to see whether the blockchain can change that. So it makes things a lot more transparent up front. And so there's this, as you can see from that Forbes story there, that these blockchain startups are hoping to disrupt this $15 billion music industry. Now, I've seen that quote many times before. Back in 2001, They used to say how DRM startups were going to disrupt the $15 billion media industry, but it didn't happen. So don't get too excited about those. But again, there is a potential now. Now that we have, I suppose, more mature technology than we're back in 2001, the potential for this being true is more significant. So one of the organisations that I sort of work for is working on this blockchain music project. So it's an open project with a few number of stakeholders. So basically the idea is that we want to be able to create a new codec, which is a codec is a way that you encode audio or video, that contains what we call a minimum amount of viable data that you could use as the core content that gets distributed around the music industry. And inside that minimal data viable set, of course, will be a lot of metadata about the artist and whatever else, but also the rights information, who owns what, who gets what royalties, and what license you have as the consumer as well, and as well as the actual media as well that gets wrapped up into that. You can think about it as a big zip file with all the content nicely packaged in there in a very interoperable way. So just to break that down a bit more, the concept here, I can probably look over this thread here. So there's going to be a lot of bits in the zip file, like what the music is, and we all sort of signed, so it's all verified. Then inside here, there'll be sort of using some W3C standards, like ODRL mentioned, we'll have the actual rights and permissions that you have. There'll be some smart contracts, which I'll talk about in a moment as well. So they're related to here. And then there'll be payments at the end. So not necessarily payments in terms of bitcoins, even though that makes sense, but the industry has a lot of existing payment systems. So music royalty organisations that already exist pay their artists, so they have the mechanism to do that. So they just need to be informed that this artist needs to be paid X dollars. So it could be bitcoins, but it could be the ability to actually talk to existing stakeholders on the payment side, because not every creator is going to have a bitcoin account, for example, to accept money. So that's what we're working on at the moment, is to try and build a system. We have an the project has a very rudimentary dot blockchain sort of client at the moment that does some of that packaging, but still needs a lot more work involved in it, because some of the techniques would be also to look out, because you can't just sometimes just say I've got this music file, I own it. We want to be able to also interrogate existing databases that of rights. We wanted to talk to Spotify and say, this person says they own this music, what do you think? And then compare whether that's actually a valid statement as well. So we're not going to... the plan is not to simply just accept whatever people put into their assertions, but to also check it with well-known repositories of rights. So just give an example then of a blockchain contract. This is the company that I mentioned before, Monograph. They've got an existing service, online service for images. So basically, very simply, you can upload as a creative images, you can upload image and you can sell them. It's pretty much straightforward in that respect. But in the background, what we do is we actually create in the blockchain the contracts that specify the rights assertions we've made about that content. So here is a photograph that I uploaded. It's actually a Hong Kong building. It's from my hotel room. So it's a photograph I've uploaded. And then I can put in details in there. I can classify it. But then I can do things like I want to license it. So what's my license? I'm going to sell this for $25 whoever wants to buy it. Whether it's worth $25 or not, it's up to you to decide. And then I have my terms. You can unlimited reuse, you can remix it, but you can't resell it. You know, I've got my terms and conditions in there as well. So that's what I've specified in the actual in the system. And the way the system works is actually quite nice. Instead of having a very complex contract that you fill in, it actually gives you a sentence, a grammatical sentence that if you read it, should make sense. So this is from a user perspective, this is my contract. Now I want to sell this exclusive snapshot for $25 and the owner can resell and can remix. And the way the system works is all those purple items basically is a pop-up. So if I want to change the term to transfer or to register, I want to change exclusive to something else, I want to change snapshot to some other value, I want to change the value, I want to remove can remix, I just change it and I get a nice new sentence. So it's quite a nice user experience, which is sort of something that hasn't been focused on in the industry for rights management. It's always been focused, as I mentioned, on the back end. So once I upload my photograph and register it, so this is my photograph, it actually puts into the blockchain. You can see that little hash, that funny characters, set of characters there, the ownership title, saying that I assert to own this content, and now it's on the blockchain for everyone to see. And there's some digital fingerprints there, etc. And then when I go in and say, now I'm going to want to be able to offer a license for it, so there's the conditions in there in purple. It says what I can do, I can transfer it, I can remix it, I can resell it, I can sub-license it. So that's what I see, and these are all the big blockchain hashes in there, which shows me where in the blockchain they've been registered. And if you're really interested, that's the code behind it. It's a lot of JSON code behind it. If you love JSON, it's all in there. So that's basically now on the blockchain, and anyone can see that, and it's all registered. And if someone buys my photograph, then that will go on the blockchain. The fact that this user purchased this content for this under these conditions and paid me $25. So that everything goes on the blockchain. Every transaction just gets pushed onto the blockchain. So these contracts here are very, very factual. They're just telling me the facts. They're not very behavioural. So not much is happening in there. It's just sort of saying, here are some facts. So the other concept behind the blockchain is smart contracts. Now, I'll put smart contracts in quotes there because they're not actually smart, just so that to pre-warn you. It's a bit of a marketing term. But the idea behind a smart contract is that in the blockchain itself, you can actually have code that executes, that does something. So what a smart contract is a bit of pre-written logic, so something that's already been thought about and written in terms of a bit of computer code. It's stored in the blockchain. It's executed by the network of computers that are verifying the whole system, and then that execution of that code can actually update the blockchain itself. So it actually can create further transactions in the blockchain. So they're basically small programs that get executed in the blockchain. So the blockchain is sort of like a way that we can distribute those smart contracts around, and the smart contract itself does the actual calculation or whatever it happens to be. So that's another sort of feature, if you like, of the blockchain. So some examples of that: Barclays Bank, the big UK bank, they've been looking at the smart contracts, and they've built a little template system, if you like. So they've got there on the far side there on your right, you've got an agreement, which is typically all text. And what they can do is they can go through that agreement and they can mark up all the variables, where there's a date, where there are parties, and they want to be able to reuse that agreement. So that's, again, simple sort of factual-based contractual data. But then when they get to the part of the contract where there's a bit of calculation, so the amount of cash in the country on that day multiplied by the relevant interest rate effect of the day divided by 360. So that's part of the contract, right? A contract that the Barclays Bank has. So that bit of calculation there gets represented as a bit of code. And that bit of code goes into the blockchain as part of the transaction. So this contract has a bit of smart contract embedded in it, which is so that code can get executed as part of the transaction behind this particular Barclays agreement. So given that, that's a very simple example. So another blockchain contender out there is called Ethereum. Ethereum is it's a bit like Bitcoin, but it's another system. So it's another digital currency. So they've got their own blockchain and their own digital currency. So they have a similar thing. Ethereum's got their contracts, and they've got support smart contracts. And you see here, very complex bit of code. If you're a software engineer, you might enjoy reading all that, but it's just a complex bit of code there that does something, some type of calculation. So the big sort of again, the other disruptor here, predicted in the financial sector, is that these smart contracts that have been built actually could disrupt the legal area, because they're now trying to automate some of the terms and conditions in a legal contract. So here, this particular Financial Review story was about particularly the Ethereum blockchain and their way that they want to play a role in drafting and writing paper contracts and turning them into smart contracts and putting them onto the blockchain. So that's all good, but there's always a but to everything. So in this particular example, there was a really big but, that this Ethereum one, they was some other company, the distributed autonomous organization that used the Ethereum blockchain. They decided to issue a contract, a smart contract, for worth about $60 million of Ether, which is I suppose the Bitcoin equivalent. And what happened was some people hacked it, right? And they stole the money, the $60 million. Okay. So people say, okay, that's obviously a breach of the terms. But what it didn't actually matter, because what actually ended up being, because they had a smart contract, it didn't matter what they said was the contract. It was the code in the contract that was law. So it didn't matter what they said, only what the code did. So whatever the code did was actually the purpose of the contract. So the code had a bug in it, so therefore the bug was part of the contract. So that's why the people could actually steal and hack into the actual code. So there is a negative side to the potential having a smart contract without there being some serious, validity and checking of it. Because if some of you are familiar with Lawrence Lessig's work from Creative Commons, he wrote a great book about the code is law. And in essence saying that, you know, we get to the point in our society where when someone writes code, no matter what the law says, the code is the law, because that's what the code does. So in this case, for the smart contract, the bug is the law as well. So even though you've unfortunately coded a bug into your contract, that's the law, because the bug is part of the contract. So it's a very, very dangerous area that we're actually getting into. And as you can see from this tweet here, that you're going to not only hire lawyers to look at contracts, but you're going to have a look at hackers to help you make sure there's no holes in your contract as well. So really the good thing about, one way of looking at this is that the smart contracts are really good for computational things. So if you've got a little algorithm that you need to run, then like for payments, that's certain periodical payments, then you could use a smart contract, put that as part of your larger contract into the blockchain. But then other contract terms, the more logical stuff, should be expressed differently than code, because code is code. It's not really, code was never meant to express the semantics of a contract. No one's, you know, it was never designed to do that. But a language like ODRL, the one that we're building at W3C, that's a type of language that has the semantics behind expressing what people should be able to do, not do, what your obligations are, in a very logical sense. because the smart contract is only interested in numbers, computing numbers or time periods and multiplying things, so it won't have the same semantics as a more generic framework. So that's why we think that if we start using the W3C ODRL language as a contract language on the blockchain, augmented with smart contracts, so there's the actual bit of code that executes whenever a certain part of the other contract is needed, then we can probably get to the point where you can have a bit more trust in the overall contract itself. Okay, we're ahead of schedule, cool. So what's the compromise here then for disruption? So I started off at the beginning of the talk about how the rights languages, they're all pretty much focused on the technical side, heading out in that direction, a bit of business as well. And now, we've now moving into the blockchain world. We're still technical, but we're also now cutting into the legal world as well, because it's cutting into the contract world where the legal fraternity sort of typically has a great say. But I think it's got but with those together, we can sort of solve a lot more of the value chain, particularly in the examples I showed you so far. The music one is a good example because there's so many players in that space that if it works there, then it'll be certainly be a good contender for the future. Then, of course, we always have the missing social part, and DRM's always been a word that's either polarized the community. But I recently saw someone else refer to DRM instead of digital rights management, but using the term digital rights to manage, because that's in essence what you're doing. We have rights available to us, as you know, through copyright and other laws, and so we need to manage them. So it shouldn't be something that people are scared of or afraid that that's going to take away my rights, because typically I think that period of fear, if you like, has moved on. You know, the turning off my little text-to-speech reader, my Adobe player, that's something that we shouldn't even be thinking about anymore. So your rights aren't being taken away, but what they try and do is augment your rights to try and make sure your rights are managed more effectively than without this technology. And that's where the music industry suffers badly, because there's poor management of rights. So with the blockchain, with a smart contract and a very even smarter contract language like ODRL, we think we can actually solve that bigger problem. Hopefully I'm a bit early, but that's the end of my talk. Hopefully you've got an idea about where digital contracts are heading, some of the technology that's going on, some of the players, some of the issues, and hopefully that inspired you to think more about the problem. So thanks very much.